I'm going to pull
right now. We're starting to get a little concerned.
Yeah, it's getting bad.
Yeah, the lake is looking a little peaked.
Oh, I know that sometimes islands are popping up.
Yeah, everywhere.
Could be just about sometimes peninsula.
Right?
Yeah.
I need to set up a Zoom meeting to meet with a friend. And I have gone into my Zoom account. Uh-huh. And I've scheduled the meeting, but I can't, and I don't have a paid account. I want to do one of the free ones.
Right.
And I don't know how to invite her.
Okay. I can, after class, maybe we, you and I
could
can
you
talk
do
about that?
That.
Sure.
Do you want me to call you or do you want me to just stay on the Zoom?
Well, it might be good to stay on the Zoom and I can kind of show you how it works.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
I will.
Who's talking?
I want to watch.
I want to watch what?
I want to watch how to do it also.
Yeah, and it's fairly easy. The only limitations, if you've got a free account, which everyone has, you're limited to 40 minutes, I think.
Except Thanksgiving. They're letting everybody
have are they? Okay. But and you're limited in the number of participants, but I can't remember what that limit is.
I guess.
This morning, my grandson and I and his family did a FaceTime, so that was fun. Yeah, I can't do FaceTime because I don't have an iPhone. I have an Android. No, I have an iPad. I don't have a phone.
Yeah,
but yours.
Got to turn it on down here.
You can. There's a camera process with just a regular Android phone that you can also do.
Yes, I've done Facebook
video calls.
Yeah, so. Facebook video calls.
Yeah.
Well, thank Judy you. And I spent probably an hour this last week setting up my in-laws, her sister and her husband setting up on Zoom. They had never used it before. But we decided that we wanted to get together on Thanksgiving for maybe 30 minutes and just talk. And so it was quite an adventure getting them set up. because they had never even tried anything like that before. And I had to get them to download some software. They didn't have a good browser and it was all kind of stuff. But anyway,
it worked.
And their daughter who lives here in Austin just showed up at the front door a few minutes ago. And we chatted for a bit and she said, Mom and Dad told me what y'all did for him. She said, I'm so glad we can finally get together on Zoom. So we're going to see if that works.
Good for you. Yeah.
So how many of you have used Duo? D-U-O.
No.
I have a doctor because I don't have an iPhone. I have a Android. I use Android. And he said, oh, well, you just use Google Duo, D-U-O. And it was so easy to set up, and we had a good meeting.
Huh. Okay.
It's like two people over your cell phones. Huh. And actually, I went ahead and found, and they'll give you a list of all the people that use it that you have in your phone book, and you can call them. Huh. I actually did that one time, but anyway, you might try that if you don't have iPhone.
Yeah. All right. Well, very good. Anything else, anyone, before we get moving? Okay. We're going to go ahead and start the class. As you hopefully you noticed in the email I sent you, we're going to be covering a book called God in the Pandemic by N.T. Wright. And I'm going to get that going. And the first thing I'm going to do, warning, I'm going to mute everyone. And we'll see if that works.
Mute.
It doesn't always work. it's got about half of you muted.
We can mute ourselves.
Yeah. Okay, it's got, let's see. Okay, seems to be working now. Okay, good. Yeah. All right. Excellent. Let's see. I'm going to mute all. Okay. Okay, I think I'm the only one whose mic is working now. Okay, let's get started. I'm going to open with prayer. Our dear Heavenly Father, we do thank you again for this wonderful opportunity we have to come together in friendship and love and to study together and work together. Be with us as we continue this study and others. And we pray for our church and the congregation and facing what's going to be going on, it looks like, for a little more time period here with this pandemic. And be with all of us as we go through this. We ask all this in your name. Amen. Okay, I'm going to turn on the screen. And okay, if you can see that, this is the book. It's called God and the Pandemic. And the subtitle is interesting also. It says, A Christian Reflection on the Coronavirus and Its Aftermath by N.T. Wright. Now, if you have never read N.T. Wright, just mention a few things about it. He's he is a great New Testament, well, really biblical scholar, and very well known. He has written over 80 books on biblical studies, and some of them are monstrous books. It's really impressive how much work he's done in this area. And when we get to the opening the book in the preface, which I'll have a little summary of on the next slide, on that preface, we will see how this book came about, because this is an unusual Wright book. I'm aware of one Wright book that's 1,600 pages long, and I don't believe anyone has ever read the whole thing. But he writes big books. But this book is about, I think it's about 80 pages. I don't have it right in front of me right now, but it's a small book. And so he talks about on this very first slide, he talks about why this book, how this came about. It did not come about because he was planning to write this book. That's the key thing here. In the preface, he said, this little book would not have been written had it not been for the invitation from Time Magazine to write a short piece early in the COVID-19 pandemic. He wrote this in about the middle of this summer, I think. So it's considerably worse than that now than when he wrote it. But this is why he wrote it. And once he wrote it and he spent so much time writing this little thing for Time Magazine, he decided he had come to some interesting ideas, and he thought it was appropriate to put it into a book. He deliberately tried to make it a short book, though, because he knew that it would be difficult for a lot of people to read the longer book. I will tell you a little about Wright. I'm a big fan of N.T. Wright, and mainly because he's quite challenging. He makes it hard. He actually challenges you a lot, and it can be very provocative in the way he reviews things. And so he has critics because of that. But I'm a great admirer of him, except in one area, and that's in how he writes books. He is not what you would call a concise writer. Some critics have referred to his writing style as leisurely and conversational, which means he just goes on and on. And you begin to wonder when he's going to get to the point. And it drives some people kind of crazy. But it's a friendly writing style, and but that's the way he prefers to do. I actually get more out of his YouTube interviews and things like that, where people are interviewing him and they're keeping a tight leash on him. They're asking him a very specific question and he has to answer it. He does very well at that. But his books can be take a long time to figure out what he's trying to say sometimes. Anyway, so that's just some of my thoughts, but we'll get into that as we keep moving through here. Okay, now, this is another thing out of his preface. He said, this present discussion is a further attempt to tease out what may wisely and biblically be said at a time like this. He says, as the weeks of the lockdown have gone on, I suppose most people have gone through a range of emotions about it all. But it seems to me important to keep out our reactions within a biblical limit. And this is what I'm going to try to do here. And he makes the point, not just here, but in other parts of the book, he will refer to this, But he basically said, you know, he said, I'm not an epidemiologist and don't pretend to be. I'm not a politician. I don't know the best things to do about a lot of these things. But he said, so I thought I better stick to what I'm really good at, which is biblical stuff. And so that's what he's trying to do here. But it's quite entertaining the way he does it. And so this is what he's up to. Now, he goes on from there and says, the aim of the book is not to offer solutions to the questions raised by the pandemic or to give any sort of complete analysis of what we might learn from it or what we necessarily have to do now. He said, my main argument is we need to get away from knee-jerk reactions that come so readily to mind. And he will give you a lot of examples of that. He's been a little disappointed in how a lot of people have reacted to it and the questions they're asking. And he said, but before we can answer those questions and anything other than the broadest outline, he thinks we need a little time of lament and of restraint and not jumping to all these solutions. We need to think about what's going on. And I will mention a number of themes he uses all through the book. One of this is this time of lament. And because one of the things he has found in the scriptures is that in times of extreme crisis in biblical times, both Old Testament and New Testament, lament is often what Christians do. And he says, it doesn't hurt to do that. And he gives some, a lot of examples of that. And we'll talk about it when we get into some of these scriptures. And he said, these solutions may eventually come, God willing, but unless we retreat from our instant reactions, we probably won't be able to hear them well. If we spend some time in the prayer of lament, maybe new light will come rather than simply the repetition of things we wanted to say anyway. And so he's trying to get away from all these, what he calls knee-jerk reactions. Now, I said he's got some themes through this book. Let me just kind of mention a few of them, but there'll be more as we go through. Just in this preface, we've already seen some emergence of a few themes. He suggested a time of lament should be needed, and we'll get into that. He said, why do we need to lament? He said, humanity around the globe is suffering through sickness, confusion, and death, and it's in the millions. And he said, Christians should be very concerned about that and should be lamenting about it. He said, it's a very Christian thing to do. And people of faith have always lamented in these times of crisis. And the crisis and the laments can all be found in the biblical record, as he intends to show us. And it's kind of interesting how he does that. And then finally, he suggests we might consider doing the same thing before jumping to any quick answers about why this happened and who we should blame, which he said we're doing too much of already. And he's identified several of those knee-jerk reactions and from around the globe. And he doesn't think they've been very helpful to date. And there'll be a few other themes that will appear as we proceed. And I'll try to point them out as we get into the rest of his book. Now, he starts out to give you a view of what he saw happening here. And this was kind of interesting. He said, I was reminded of an ironic quote from a Lutheran pastor, Martin Niemöller, speaking about Nazi Germany in the 1930s. And he said, first they came for the Jews, but I did nothing because I'm not a Jew. He said, then they came for the socialists, but I did nothing because I'm not a socialist. And then they came for the Catholics, but I did nothing because I'm not a Catholic. Finally, they came for me, but by then there was no one left to help me. And Wright goes on to say, he said, this kind of sounded like the way we in America and England kind of went through this thing. He said, so it has been, I thought, with the British and American reaction to the virus. First it hit the Chinese, but we said we aren't Chinese. And anyway, China is so far away and they do strange things like eating pangolins. And he said, then it hit Iran, but we didn't worry too much because Iran too is very far away. And anyway, it's a very different place. And then it struck her closer to home in Italy. But we thought, well, those Italians are sociable, tactile people. They touch each other a lot. Of course it'll spread there, but we proper British people will be just fine. And then it arrived in London and then in New York. And suddenly there was no safe place on the planet. And he said, So he said, we kind of reacted the way that they did in Nazi Germany in a sense. And he said, we just didn't think it was going to be that bad. And we waited way too late to do anything. Now, so then he raises the question, what is really going on? And he's pretty clear about it. He's not sure. He said, does anybody really know what's going on? Why is all this happening? is someone trying to tell us something? And what are we supposed to do about it? And so he goes back to ancient times at this point. And he said, in most of the ancient world, and in frankly, many parts of the modern world too, anytime there's a major disaster, whether it's earthquakes or tsunamis or volcanoes or fires or plagues like this one, they're usually associated with angry gods. That's the way the ancients always thought. Something bad has happened. It must be because someone has it in for you. Now, in the old pagan world of Greece and Rome, the assumption was you hadn't offered yet the right sacrifices to the right God, or you hadn't said the right prayers to the right God, or you did something so truly dreadful that even the old immoral gods on Mount Olympus felt it was time to just crack down on you. And this was the kind of way people looked at things. And he said, but this was a time in which the great Greek philosophers were hard at work. And he said, these high-minded philosophers didn't think much of any of those arguments about the gods. They came up with three alternative ways of looking at things, which Wright will eventually say, wasn't that helpful either. He said, here's the philosophical answers. He said, the Stoics, famous Greek philosophers, they basically said, everything is programmed to turn out the way it does. Stuff happens, you can't change it. So just learn to fit in and then you'll be happy. And he said, okay, that's one approach. He said, but then the Epicureans were saying, and they were disagreeing with the Stoics, no, it's not programmed, it's random. You still can't do anything about it. So make yourself as comfortable as you possibly can. And then there were the Platonists, Aristotle and Plato. They said something different. They said, the present life is just a shadow of reality. And bad things happen here, but we're destined for a different world anyway. So again, don't worry about it. Now, in Wright's view, most of the modern West is implicitly Epicurean. Stuff happens, but we just want to scramble for comfort. So just settle down, self-isolate, and watch plenty of Netflix, and this too will pass. He said that that's okay, but he said to him, that's not good enough. But he said some, including some Christians, they opt for Plato. Death isn't the worst thing that happened. We're heading for somewhere else anyway, so let's just be sensible, but please don't shut down our churches or our golf clubs, whatever you do. And so there's a whole lot of different reactions to all this, and none of them are completely very satisfactory to him. And so he raises, what are the right questions we should be asking? And this is kind of another theme of his that I've seen in some of his books. He said, he raises the issue, what are the questions Christians and the Christian church should be asking instead of the why questions? He doesn't like why questions very much. He said, they tend to be very philosophical and no one agrees on the right answer to why. And these are questions like, why is this happening to us? Somebody explain it to me. And he rather would switch to different kind of questions. So an example of that he gives, this happened in the UK, he claims. He said that when the pandemic hit at its worst point in the summer this year, the government was just overwhelmed. And in the UK, it's the National Health Service that takes care of everyone. And they asked for volunteers. Could anyone volunteer to help the National Health Service with all the extra urgent but non-specialist tasks that have to be done? We need more hands. And they were shocked that 500,000 people signed up at once. So many, it was hard to find any appropriate tasks for them to do. So it was, and Wright said he likes to think that a lot of those were Christians. But many retired doctors and nurses came back to the front line. Some of them themselves, they caught the virus and died. So people are willing to do things. And it gives him some clues about maybe what should be done. But what he particularly wanted to point out, he says what they were doing was what the early Christians did in times of plague. And this was kind of interesting because he has done a lot of research into this, and so have many other people, about how the Christians behaved in the first centuries. And so he presents that evidence in the book. And he says, what did the Christians do? He said, in the first few centuries, and here he's talking about the first few centuries after Jesus. So he's talking about second, third, and fourth centuries, roughly. When serious sickness would strike a town or a city, the well-to-do would run for the hills. He said, the common, one belief they all had, even though they didn't understand what these plagues were usually. They never could figure out where, what they were. But their normal assumption was, just from observation, they noticed that when they were around people who were sick, they got sick. So they said, if you could afford it, and if you had a summer villa somewhere, head for the hills. And so the well-to-do always got out of town as quickly as possible. But he said, it's recorded in Roman history that the Christians, a lot of Christians stayed behind and nursed people. Sometimes they caught the disease and died. And people were astonished. And what was all that about? Well, Wright's answer was, oh, they replied, we're followers of this man, Jesus. And he put his life on the line to save us. So we're going to do that too. And nobody had ever thought about that thing before in the ancient world. And Wright says, no wonder the gospel spread fast, even when the Romans were doing their best to stamp it out. Now, he then gets into some of the research into this, and it turns out there's been quite a bit. This is well described in a man named Romney Stark wrote a book called The Rise of Christianity in 1996. And Wright argues that he makes a very compelling case that the way Christians behaved in the great plagues in the early centuries of Christianity was a very significant factor contributing to the spread of the faith as rapidly as it moved. He and others gathered evidence from the plagues, and that when they said evidence, they looked through Roman history, historical books about it, from the plagues of the 170s AD, which killed the Roman emperor, Marcus Aurelius. He didn't get out of town in time, as well as the plagues of the 250s AD. And so there was all of this going on. And interestingly, there was a Roman emperor later, Julian. He was after Constantine. So this was after the Roman Empire had made Christianity the imperial religion. An emperor named Julian came along, and he tried unsuccessfully to deconvert the Roman Empire away from Christianity. He wanted to get back to the old gods of the Roman Empire and the pagan gods. But he failed. And he later complained in some of his writings that his efforts were difficult because those darn Christians are so much better at taking care of sick and poor people. And people took notice. Something new was happening. And so that this was a lot of historical information that the Christians were doing something that had never been done before. And carrying on that a little further, he said, fascinating is that much of the world picked up on the hint. And another very good historian that Wright likes, Tom Holland, has argued in a recent book called Dominion that much of what we take for granted today in the modern world and social attitudes, and here he's talking about taking care of the poor, taking care of sick people, supporting hospitals, hospices, everything in bad times, was actually a Christian innovation. It had never happened before in any of these old empires. They just didn't think it was something that they were responsible for. And he said the ancient pagans didn't do it like that. Why? Well, medicine, if there was any, cost money, and so did education. And the poor were poor, so most of these empires assumed, because they were either lazy or born into the wrong family. It wasn't society's job to look after them at all. It never was in these old societies. But the Christians disagreed with that. And Wright says they picked up their rule of life from the Jews via that Jew named Jesus, of course. And they thought differently because the Jews had these texts, these scriptures. This is Wright's voice here now. He said, which kept on circling back to the belief that there was one God who had a special concern for the poor, the sick, the outcast, the prisoners, the slaves. And they believed that, and they acted on it. And so you can probably see where he's going here. He's kind of starting to ask the question, is the modern day Christian church thinking this way or not? But he pointed this out. And when we get into what he's going to do with going through the scriptures, he's going to show you some of those scriptures and how compelling they are. But then it continued. It was the churches, if you go through then the rest of the development of the church all through Europe for the next 10 centuries, it was the churches that first built hospitals and hospices that actually were taking care of the very poor. Governments never did that in the old Holy Roman Empire or anything like that. And the followers of Jesus were the first in the field of general education for the not for the non-wealthy. And they made education available outside the circles of the rich and the elite, often by starting up schools within their churches for children. So Christianity led the way on a lot of these things. But then he points out, but from the time of Jesus until the last century or two, plagues have constantly returned to humanity and to the people of this time, often with terrifying consequences. And this is another theme he goes through, is that he wants to totally acknowledge that COVID-19 is a horrible event, but that it doesn't compare to some of the ones we read about that happened in world history. And many of us have assumed that we're kind of exempt from all those bad things before because we had vaccines, but this time apparently we didn't have them in time. So throughout church history, Christians just continued to get on with the job. They visited the sick, they visited the prisoners, they cared for the wounded, they fed the hungry. And it was noticed by people. And it's been one of the big attractions to it in a lot of parts of the world. And it didn't stop in those times. There's an interesting letter from Luther. It's called the letter of Spiritual Counsel. And this happened during the Reformation. Martin Luther faced several deadly plagues in the 1520s and again in the 1530s. This is while they were going through all the Reformation battles and struggles. And in his letter to both church and civic leaders, he insisted that preachers and pastors should remain at their posts. As good shepherds, they should remain at their post. And likewise, he wrote to all the civic and family leaders, they should only flee from a plague if they first made proper provision for the safety of those left behind. So this kind of thinking was still very strong in Christianity in the Reformation. This is a good 12 centuries later. And I got a copy of that letter, Spiritual Counsel. He wrote it in 1527, and this is typical Martin Luther strong language, but he's making his point. He said, "With God's permission, the enemy has sent us poison and deadly dung among us. So I will pray to God that he may be gracious and preserve us. But then I will fumigate to purify the air. I will give and take medicine if I have it. And I will avoid places and persons where I'm not needed in order that I may not abuse myself and that through me others may not be infected and inflamed with the result that I become the cause of their death through my negligence. But if God wishes to take me, he will be able to find me. And at least I've done what he gave me to do, and I'm responsible neither for my own death nor the death of others. But if my neighbor needs me, I shall avoid neither person nor place, but feel free to visit and help." So he very strongly was trying to tell people, this is your Christian duty in times of plagues. Now, so that kind of a break right there. And then Wright starts asking the question, so what has our modern Christian response been so far? And it's pretty clear from what he's saying, although he doesn't say it directly. He says the response has been pretty disappointing to him to date. He said that's not mean we can't respond, but he said so far he's not very encouraged by what he's hearing. He said some are simply wringing their hands and asking those why questions again. And he said which are not very useful at this point. He said some are simply playing the blame game. It's China's fault or somebody else's. Some of them are saying God's trying to send us a message. We've each individually sinned and he's sending us a message. Some are eagerly saying, this is a sign of the end times. We can't wait so we can go to heaven. And some are saying, this is our chance to tell everyone about Jesus in heaven. And maybe this time they're going to listen. And one last one, he said, some are saying that God did this because he is very angry with us. For some reason, we're just not sure what it is. So this is what he's kind of hearing, and he's a little disappointed that the church, as well as a lot of Christians he's listening to, have focused so much on what he calls knee-jerk reactions, and instead of asking, the really important questions. So he raises the issue then of what are some better questions. He says he has his own thoughts about better questions. And it's the kind that he thinks the early Christians always ask first before anything else. They said, who is being harmed by this latest crisis? And what can we as agents of God do to help? what can the church do? What can individual Christians do? And let's start working on that. And who do we send to do this? Now, this is another theme of Wright's I might mention here that I've gotten out of some of his other books. He constantly refers to us as agents of God. And this is one thing that he thinks has been misinterpreted by a lot of Christians, and that is the notion of the sovereignty of God. John Calvin wrote a lot about God's sovereignty, that God is all powerful and can do everything. And he thinks a lot of Christians have kind of misinterpreted what Calvin was really trying to say, because in his view, the sovereignty of God, in Wright's view, the sovereignty of God, he thinks is spelled out in Scripture as the way God accomplishes things is through his image bearers, his agents, his people of faith, and that we're supposed to be organizing to do what God wants us to do, and that we're not thinking of it that way. We keep saying, why didn't God stop this? And he said that he would like to turn that question around. So he does that quite a bit in the rest of the book. Now, so where do we begin? Wright wants to do this in a biblical perspective because, again, that's what he knows best. And his suggestion is he's going to begin with the Old Testament in this book, because that's where a lot of the apparently key texts can be found that might supply some of the answers. And then he's going to progress to the Gospels and then the remaining parts of the New Testament. And we'll be doing that as we go through this book. And he obviously can't put everything that's in the Old and New Testament in his book, and we can't do it in this class, but he points out some of the key texts that we ought to be thinking about. And he makes a point here again that he's done this in a lot of his book, is that he maintains that most Christians, though they may have multiple Bibles in their homes, never read them the way they should be read. And he said they too often use them for proof texts to justify looking up a few verses to justify some of their predetermined beliefs. And Wright strongly suggests that we only learn the wisdom of the Bible by reading the books, not only frequently, but completely. And he's very strong. He says, if you're going to study the book of Mark, read the whole thing from beginning to end so you can get all the context and understand what he's really talking about. But any book, and that's including the Old Testament and New Testament, because these are narratives and they can teach us through the entire combined story of the Bible, humanity's relationship to God. And that's what he thinks the way we should read the Bible at all times. That's the way he reads it, he says. And quite obviously, most modern Christians don't read the Bible that way. But where do we read in the Old Testament? And here he raises the issue of where we need to look is, did the writings of the Hebrew Bible ever have to deal with anything as bad as we're seeing in 2020? And he immediately says, that's of course a rhetorical question. Of course they did. And his view is, let's look at the greatest disaster of all, and it's the Babylonian exile. And he said, that's where we see something so dramatically worse than 1 or 2 years of a pandemic, because it went on for centuries after that, where the Hebrews lost literally everything they thought was important in the Babylonian exile. And we're going to remind you of what that is in just a minute. So to understand that magnitude and what happened to this relatively small kingdom, remember the kingdom of Israel was a small kingdom. It was sort of a third world kingdom among major world powers, but it requires a deep understanding of what happened over an extended period of time to them. And an understanding that most people of faith, again, Wright says, don't get from their cursory manner of studying the biblical record. So what I want to do is quickly give you a very brief review of what he's talking about here, Israelite history. And so this is just a history 101 of Israel, but it's divided up into the pre-monarchic period. And I'm going to give you a lot of dates here, but I'm not going to defend the dates, because I think I've told you many times, all these dates are scholarly guesswork and scholars don't always disagree about the exact dates, but I'm just going to put the ones that are often used. The pre-monarchic period was the entire period before there were kings in Israel. And so the pre-monarchic period begins in Genesis. So they are the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their highly dysfunctional families. Then there was Egypt, Joseph, slavery, Moses, the Exodus, and then Joshua in the interest of the promised land, and Judges, which was a gradual transition of the tribes into eventually a nation and monarchs. And fortunately, we just finished with Chris Knepp's help, Joshua and Judges, so you're fairly familiar with that. Then there was a monarchic period, and here's where they first moved into having kings. Israel moved to a monarchy with Saul in 1020. The United monarchy came after that, and that's just the term that a lot of scholars use. It was David and Solomon, 1930. And then after that, there was a major split into the divided kingdoms. There was Israel in the north, which was 9 tribes or 10 sometimes, so it depends on how you want to count them. And then Judah in the south, 2 or 3 tribes. And those were 2 different time periods. They both started in 930 when they split. But then you can see in 721, Israel was carried off into captivity. And then Judah was safe until 586, and they were carried off in the Babylonian exile. And by the way, that division was caused by political differences, and the two kingdoms never got along after that. In fact, they came to blows occasionally in warfare. So we're continuing with this very brief review. The southern kingdom of Judah survived for many years after the formation of the divided monarchies. During that entire period, it was the family of David and Solomon that ruled it. And then the northern kingdom never did have a consistent royal family like the Davidic kings, but it did have a formal capital in the city of Samaria for a while. But in the year 721, Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom totally, including its capital city of Samaria, and exiled the population to Mesopotamia to work in Assyria and surrounding regions. And I'll show you a map in a minute, but this is because all these empires came out of roughly the same area. But that Assyria doing that to the northern kingdom effectively ended the northern kingdom of Israel. And we actually never hear from it again in the biblical narrative. They don't talk about it. They're gone. Fortunately for Judah, the Assyrians apparently had enough problems of their own, probably back home. They didn't attempt to conquer Judah. Apparently the city of Jerusalem was just too tough with its big, tall walls and everything, because they had a great deal of trouble capturing Samaria in the northern kingdom. It took them 4 years of surrounding the city and holding it in siege until they finally had to give up. And I think that Assyria was having problems by then because the Babylonians were coming up from behind them, and they probably decided they didn't want to spend another 4 or 5 years trying to take Jerusalem down. So they left them alone, although they actually surrounded them and required that they be paid an annual fee to be left alone. So they had to divvy up a lot of money every year to send to Assyria so that they'd leave them alone. Now, just a map to show you what we're talking about here. And I hope this is clear on your screens, but this is 2 different time periods of the Assyrian empire. And the one, if you see where I'm going with this pointer, this is the blue one. This was in the years 858 to 824. And this was under one of the kings. This is where the Assyrian Empire had expanded to. But then later they got bigger and bigger. And the outer one here, this one that's a different color, that goes all the way down and covers all of this area and all of Egypt. This was the Assyrian Empire by the year 668 to 627. So it was a massive empire and very powerful. And you can see a few things. It shows Judah as being encircled by a little green thing. In other words, they never captured Judah. They left it alone in return for money, but it was part of their empire. And but when they actually came down, after they took the Northern Kingdom, they actually just went past and went to their real prize they were after, which was Egypt, and they captured a great deal of Egypt. Now, that's the that empire. Now, the what I'm going to show you next is the Persian Empire, because what happened here was after that, the Babylonians came and defeated the Assyrians, and the Babylonians were the one who came and took Jerusalem and took them into the Babylonian, into their empire. But this was the Persian Empire here, who later came and captured all of the Babylonian Empire. So this was the other great empire that existed this time. And the point I want to make here is that during all of this time, there was no longer a Judah or an Israel. They were gone, and they were all part of major empires. They had lost everything that they had owned previously. And just continuing this very brief review, then we get finally to the post-monarchic period. And it's divided into three periods. And the Babylonian exile was the first one. And the Babylonian exile did not last very long, but it was much worse than it looks. It only lasted, I think, 48 years or something like that. I can't remember the exact number. Well, do the math. It resulted from the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the deportation of many of the people in Jerusalem to Mesopotamia and actually into the area around Babylon. So they were exiled there, but it didn't last that long because the Persians almost immediately took over and defeated the Babylonians. And so they became part of the Persian Empire, and they were part of that empire all the way for the next couple of hundred years. And it commenced with the Persian conquest of the Babylonians and the later decree by their king, Cyrus, to allow all the Jews that wanted to return to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple, which was dedicated in the year 516. This was the second temple. Now, that sounds like good news for the Jews, except they didn't get anything but the right to go back and build a temple. They did not get their land back at all. They were part of the Persian Empire, and don't you forget it. And they were a very small province in the Persian Empire. They had lost just about everything. And then finally, the conquest of Alexander the Great, 333, who then completely defeated the Persians and took over everything. It was another major turning point, but we're not going to be talking about that right now. And the period after that was typically is called the Late Antiquity, or sometimes the Greco-Roman world. Now, the point I wanted to make is all of this, starting with this Babylonian exile, was just nothing but horrible news for the people of Israel and Judah, because there were very substantial differences between the monarchic period where they had kings and the post-monarch periods where they no longer had a king and no longer owned the land at all. And Judah itself was actually a relatively prosperous kingdom during the entire monarchic period, even the last decades before the destruction of the temple. It was not a world power by any means. It was still sort of a third world country, but it was a wealthy third world country. And Jerusalem at that time was an important city, and the population of about 25,000 people was about a third of the kingdom as a whole, about 75,000 people. And they were doing quite well until suddenly they didn't exist anymore. But post-monarchic Judah, after the Persians made them the province of Judah, the province of Yehud was the old area that was Judah, but they were now just a province of a great empire, and it was much smaller and poorer province than anything they experienced before. For instance, the population in Jerusalem in the second half of the Persian period, all the way to 332, was about 1,500 inhabitants in Jerusalem, as opposed to the 25,000 up here. It was much, much smaller. And the province of Yehud, which began in 538, it reached a population peak maybe only of about 17,000 during the next 200 years. So as opposed to the 75,000 that had been before. So it was a tiny, insignificant province in a major, major empire. And this once independent Davidic kingdom, which had been around for many, many years, 340 or so years, ruled by Davidic kings, was now a relatively small peripheral province in a large Persian empire. And the fall of Jerusalem then had more, actually had a lot more than just the political, because they lost all their political power. And there was a demographic problem because many of their people were killed in this takeover. And it had major economic impact because they never had control of anything after that. And from an insider's religious perspective, it was even worse. If you were a person of faith and trying to live in the covenant with God, when the monarchic period came to a close, first of all, you lost Jerusalem, which they considered the Lord's city given to them. You lost the temple, which was the Lord's house. And you lost the Davidic dynasty, which was the Lord's chosen dynasty. They were all gone at once. And this went on for literally for centuries, 200 to 300 years. And then it went on after that, because they were never anything but part of being swallowed up by empires after that. After that, it was the Greeks, and then after Alexander, and then after that, it was the Roman Empire took over. And so everything they had that had been promised to them and part of the covenant was gone. And they did get the temple back, but that's the only thing they got back. So as you can imagine, there's no doubt that these represent a watershed in the history of Judah and ancient Israel, and were understood by those who lived after these events. So it was really, really bad times. Now, where does Wright go with all this? Well, he's going to say, he starts to ask the question, what can we learn about any of this, about how to respond to our pandemic? And what he proposed to do is, he would like to focus on biblical insight, because a great deal of Old Testament literature was actually composed during these bad times that we talk about, these 200 or 300 years of bad time. For instance, the Book of Lamentations was written entirely in Babylon, in that area. A great deal of the Psalms was written in the 400s, well after all this had fallen. Now, a lot of Christians like to read the encouraging, beautiful Psalms of praise of God, but about a third of the Psalms are deep lamentations. If you've ever gone through the entire Book of Psalms, as again, Wright suggests you do, you'll see that it's full of not just sad lamentations, but bitter and angry lamentations, many of them against God. And it's important to read all those things to understand what they were going through. And so he says, that's what I'm pointing out here, a significant part of Old Testament scripture was written during this exile. And those were the really, really bad times for people of Israel and Judah, including quite a bit of the Psalms, the Book of Lamentations, others like Daniel, many other books. And so we're going to begin next week reviewing some of that material and take a dive into that book, Job. And which was, we don't know exactly when Job was written, but it gets into a lot of these issues of how do you deal with horrible things happen to you. And then when we get through that, though, we'll move on to the Gospels and then the remainder of the New Testament, where we'll find a lot of very similar things, including lament in those. And then he'll wrap up with some of his thoughts on what the Christian response might be to the pandemic. So that's where we're heading next week. We'll be moving into the Old Testament and getting Wright's interpretation of what some of these things that were happening during those times. And he's trying to lead us down the road of what can all this teach us about what we should be doing about this going forward. And that wraps up this week's presentation. And I will get us back to, ta-da. And feel free to turn on your mics again. Questions about any of this?
Oh, Mike, I know that Stacy is planning to teach this book and another one by Brueggemann on her Monday morning women's Bible study beginning in mid-January.
Okay. Good, good.
And it's a Zoom class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And Mike, have you read the Brueggemann book? I haven't.
It's No, I have not.
Virus as a summons. What is virus as a summons? Faith. Yeah.
Okay.
Title of the Brueggemann.
Virus as a summons to faith.
Okay.
Virus as a summons to faith. We just don't know what to say after all that.
This was so excellent.
Don't say anything.
Well, the sun does come up every morning.
It does.
And sometimes I think we forget to look at some of the blessings that are surrounding us and get too hung up on the negative.
Yep.
I mean, I will say, because I've read the Wright book, that, I mean, as you said, his work is very provocative, but I mean, I find it very challenging, and frankly, you know, what we'd have to do if you're going to hold to be held accountable as Christians in the aftermath of this. I mean, and I, after I read his book, I checked out the church library has that Rodney Stark book, where Stark talks about the history of the early Christians and how they did exactly what Wright said. He said, Christians were the ones who said, wait a minute, we have to take care of these people. And that was a whole new concept of social justice.
I think it calls out Father Damien, who we studied in Hawaii with the lepers.
Right.
Mother Teresa, I mean, and close to home, the work that the gathering has been doing, the volunteers in the gathering, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
There are just some wonderful examples of
And you may remember we taught, I actually taught a little 1 week course on Catherine of Siena.
It
was about a year ago, I think. But you know, that was a major plague that hit the area around Siena in Italy. And there was a Christian hospital there that had been built by the Christians. And a whole lot of people were in that hospital dying. And she was a nun. And this was not part of her responsibility, but she left her normal duties and went straight into the hospital and just worked there around the clock for almost a year. And the plague finally went away and she survived it all and went back to work. And within about, I think, 5 or 10 years later, the plague returned and she went right back into the hospital again. And she said that was her duty. And she survived both of them, actually.
Looking positive. It's having a positive attitude about having a positive attitude. What can you do? Not just bring your hands.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you help the people you can.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have any nursing skills. I never did have, but I have neighbors or I have friends. So you do what you can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I was also interested in what Wright says about lament. I mean, he says, of course, we should be praying. And he said, our prayers should be of lament. Mm-hmm. And I have not seen a lot of that in the church.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I mean, the big church, the Christian church.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, will you be talking about that a little bit next week? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, and the following week, this is 3 weeks. There's a lot of stuff to cover here. It'll be 3 weeks, and And we do get into that in the third week is a whole lot of what Wright starts suggesting we might want to consider doing. And that's when he gets into some of these other things, including, like Joan said, there are some things, do what you can do. And he said, don't do stupid things. Do what you can do. He said, most of us have some skills. Think about where they can be used. And he said, but don't do anything silly, like try to go in among sick people without protective equipment on. He said, that's not a smart thing to do. You just don't do those. But there are things you can do. And so he goes into all those kind of things. And he talks about this.
I found a lot to think about. And I worry a little over in Luther's letter. Mm-hmm. Because I don't see that kind of response, at least in the public sphere, by a lot of the members of the Christian faith and such in a response to this action. I'd like you to put the text of that in something where it'd be easy to kind of stare at it a little more. Because to me, that's in part of what it was saying is, don't do things to make the problem worse. Do things to protect others while you're involved.
Yeah.
But think about others and what you can and how you should do things to mitigate the problem whenever possible or desirable or even potentially useful.
Yeah, and Wright does return to that, not specifically to what Luther said, but he returns to that theme in the last part of his book when he starts talking about what can we do. And he talks very, very strongly about there are some things you can do and there are a lot of things you can do that are not dangerous too. And he specifically mentions help with the food banks. He said, during pandemics, the poor people lose their jobs, everything, people don't have enough food. And he said, there's a big demand for food banks. And we saw that on the news this morning when we were watching a little TV, that some of the food banks are shipping out 3 times more food than they ever have before right now.
So even if you can just donate $10 to the food bank, that's helpful.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me think, I know it continues, but we've had this very, very long standing thing with Manos and specifically the food bank. But of course, the mechanism by which we did that, which was to bring the bags in physically to church and leave them, is no longer a practical alternative. And
you can still do that.
You can do it. But the point is, I'm sure we're doing a lot less.
Yeah.
Doing a lot more.
But you know, they said that most helpful is to send them money because they can actually buy more with $10 than I can.
I'm just thinking individually we can do that and do. But I don't, on the other hand, I haven't really seen any publicity, any push to really up the ante on that, not just keep doing what we were doing, but double or double, triple, given the needs, double, triple. The church.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing there's things that potentially could be going on or could be happening that haven't happened yet, or haven't happened in the enlarged way that we need to be talking about. Not the same old way, not the same level, but something, the need is much bigger.
What do you have in mind, Bill?
I have nothing in mind at the moment. other than this made me think about it, that yes, we need.
Were you sitting in the
back? Yeah, well, okay. I'm not going to say, I'm a fan of Manos. I've been very indirectly involved with him for a long time. And I've tried to add a little more, but as a church, as a denomination, that's our people. Working under much more difficult circumstances and with much greater need. And I don't, you know, I couldn't, if you know, if I got a KXAN gave me an interview right now and asked the question, what is your church doing that it wasn't doing before? I don't have an answer. I would have to say, we think about it.
Yeah. Well, that, you're kind of parroting what Wright says in the book right now, because he said he's just been very surprised that the church has not spoken out about this at all, in his view. And he's using his own church too.
The Westlake Hills newsletter that comes out, I think on Thursdays, has a place where you can click for a whole list of things that we can be doing locally. The challenge is it's not right there. You got to double click. You got to dig for it. Yeah, there's a list on there every week.
There's a couple of things that strike me on that. One is you have to pursue it, which means it's not likely to bring in new people.
That's right.
Number one. And number two, years ago, I read this article, which was very interesting when it pointed out that when you give people too many choices, you actually get, it was in focused on the area of marketing and grocery stores. But a number of studies show that when you give people too many choices, they end up buying less. To give a whole menu of different things to choose from, a lot of people end up responding to that. They don't really quite know what they want to do, so they don't do anything. A point that you can potentially derive from that is you don't need a large menu. You need two or three things and say, everybody, this is what we need to do.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Kind of been, let's give everybody something that fits their particular interest. But a lot of market research says that when you do that, you get even less response.
Mm-hmm. It sort of reminds me of Nancy Pickett when she started the blue bags. She said, if you just tell people to bring food, you know, there was no specific time or what to bring or things like that. We really weren't bringing in that much food. And when she got the blue bags and set a list, that people could use that list, a whole lot more came in.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is exactly along what that marketing research had to say.
Exactly.
Physical, you need something specific, you need something where you're given explicit directions.
Yeah, I mean, the Christmas Eve offering, I think, is similar. We say, give, and it's for this purpose, or these two purposes only, and it's usually a very generous gift. Mm-hmm.
The
Paradox of Choice is the name of that book. I can't remember the author's name.
Well, one of our great examples would be the Christmas Eve offering.
Yeah.
That's what
you mean. Most successful, as far as I know.
So right. Look at 2 years ago when we bought that truck for Manos and had money left over to give them.
And it's basically, again, you have one thing.
Global loaves and fishes.
Here's what it's going to be done for. There's the choices have been made, and you get a tremendous response.
With that in mind, has anybody heard what they're going to do this year?
No.
We'll find out at the congregational meeting on the 6th.
Oh, okay.
At the 6th? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the 6th.
At 1:00.
Yeah, it's going to be a Zoom meeting at 1:00 on the 6th. Congregational meeting.
Does anybody know if we're going to continue to meet outside during December?
Well, if the weather holds up. It wasn't August.
Yeah.
Or September.
We've been going to the meetings, and I'm not sure when they move inside, we're going to continue physically going.
I don't think they're going to move inside, actually. That's
well, the session made the ruling this week that we are not going inside. I don't know what they're doing about outside, but the session made the ruling this week that we will not have worship inside in December.
This year?
So I don't know.
Nancy, your mic's off.
Nancy, you're muted.
Okay. Yeah, and that's correct what Judy said. No indoor worship for the time being, and outdoor worship, they're just going to monitor the COVID situation, you know, and if it gets so bad, they might discontinue the outdoor too. But for now, it's going to happen.
So they're going to ignore weather, huh? So it's going to be sleeting and snow and they're still going to do it?
Oh.
Sleet and snow.
Only people from Nebraska will come. If that's
snow in Texas is a...
The weather might have something to do with it, but...
According to the weatherman, the El Nino is alive and well, and we may not have any winter.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's warmer and drier than normal.
Drier and hotter.
Okay, very good. Very good discussion. Anything else?
Thank you, Mike.
Yes, thank you, Mike. That was so interesting.
All right. Well, we'll
forward to next week.
Yeah.
Could I ask just a quick prayer request? We just had a note from our son-in-law. He has a young lady who is an attorney that he supervises, who's in Fort Worth with compromised immune system because of Crohn's, and her husband just came down with COVID.
Oh no!
So if you could keep Emily and her husband in your prayers, that they make it through this crisis, would really be appreciated.
Well, we hope everybody has a wonderful Thanksgiving. Enjoy the football or whatever else is on TV, or your family and friends.
That they don't cancel.
Yeah. And we will have a book exchange once this thing calms down.
And we'll figure something out.
Maybe we'll look up something. If they need help, we can figure out some project we could all do as a class. I don't know, but we'll try to find out some information if we can. Barbara might know something, and we'll look it up.
And I knew it was bad when Westlake and Lake Travis canceled their football game.
Right.
Does that mean they both won?
Yeah.
That means they're both already qualified for state playoffs and they're not taking any chances.
That's right.
Undefeated. Although what I read in the paper today was that Lake Travis has said that if they do have a playoff game, that they would, I don't know if they said they would play or so. I don't think anybody would definitely say definite at this point, but at this point they would play it if it were a playoff game.
Yes. Yes.
Well, they do have a playoff game.
They do have a playoff game. Both of them are already in the playoffs.
Yeah, but there are different pathways to state.
Right.
Good teams.
Yes.
Everybody have a good afternoon. I'm going to check out.
And a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Everybody be safe.
Everybody cook your turkey and have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Talk to you next
time.
Bye, everybody.
So, Mike, you can stay on the line with me.
Yeah, I will.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll stay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. They're going to be online.
Well, he's helping somebody.
Okay. Rosemary wants to do.
Oh, we exited somebody else.